Mr. Abbott.
Hello. Yes, it's Tony Abbott. How are you?
Very good. Thank you for taking our call.
Thank you for having me.
We're doing a special program that should fit right into the fact that we have the opportunity of interviewing you. It's going to conclude the last decade with news around the world, and I think you're going to have very interesting comments on what happened in the past decade. Welcome to Israel. Welcome to Israel Radio.
It's lovely to be in Israel, and it's wonderful to be with you. It's a fabulous country. I always feel invigorated when I come to Israel because while Israel has some unique challenges, there's an extraordinary sense of national pride and national spirit, which many others could well emulate.
Well, you're coming to Israel in the middle of a serious political crisis. In general, you can say that the past decade has been quite intriguing and difficult for democracies around the world. Stability of democracies in question.
It's a good question. I may start by saying that whatever you think of Bibi Netanyahu and whatever your view about the current situation, I think he's certainly been a strong prime minister, and Israel is richer and safer now than it was a decade ago. And I think that Bibi and his government can take some credit for that. So I think that Israel is one of those democracies which is in a stronger position now than it was a decade ago. Obviously, if you look at countries like my own, we've had a revolving door prime ministership for much of the last decade. That's not good, but I think we are through the era of the political assassin, and I think Prime Minister Scott Morrison can expect to go through this term and hopefully more terms in the years to come. I think the election result in Britain is encouraging for all those of us who believe in governments that are sensible, whether they're centre-right or centre-left governments, and governments which respect democracy. There's no point establishing a people's vote on something if you don't then take the result seriously. And while not everyone is a fan of President Donald Trump, I think you can say this about the United States. Its economy is substantially healthier now than it was just a few years ago, and while he is very unorthodox as president, he has strengthened the US military, and I think he is much less predictable when it comes to dictatorial regimes. The job of the United States in the end is to be the leader of the free world, and I think there is more evidence with Trump of pushback against dictatorial and oppressive regimes than there was under his predecessor. So,
well, some would argue that because of the Russia affair and because of the attempts to mend relations with North Korea and now actually very improving relations with China, in an agreement that is going to be signed between China and the United States. So is President Trump protecting democracy?
Look, you can argue the toss on all of these issues, but in my judgment, under President Trump, the United States has worked out that China is a strategic competitor, not simply an economic opportunity, but a strategic competitor. I don't think this is something which is going to disappear with the Trump presidency whenever that might end. I think that the United States polity, more or less across the board, has worked out that China is different from other countries, that everything China does is done with strategic intent, that a Chinese business, you can't deal with it the same way you might deal with a British business or a French business or an Indian business, that every Chinese business is, in a sense, an agent of the Chinese government and ultimately of the Chinese Communist Party. I think this realization has well and truly dawned in the United States, and increasingly it's dawning elsewhere. If you ask me what are the big things of this decade, I'd say that the appreciation of the challenge of China is certainly one of the big changes. I think that the Western world has continued to suffer from a serious self-doubt over the last decade, and I think it's exacerbated by the rise of what are effectively new religions like the climate cult. And there is an ongoing Islamist challenge. This is not something that we only discovered this decade. It's been obvious, at least since September the 11th, 2001, that there was a serious Islamist challenge. But as the decade draws to a close, I think that there are some hopeful signs, as I say, that the West is waking up to the reality of contemporary China. I think that the Brexit vote and the re-election of the Johnson government is a sign that Britain too is determined to exercise its sovereignty, and I think the world will be better for that. And while we still seem to be in the grip of the climate cult, sooner or later, the climate cult is going to produce policy outcomes which will cause people to wake up to themselves. In my own country, for instance, we've been running our electricity system for the last decade or so, not to produce affordable and reliable power, but to reduce emissions. Now, the impact of this has been to drive a lot of industry offshore, to put power prices through the roof, and to produce the sorts of blackouts which have been unknown in our country for almost 30 years. So sooner or later, in the end, people get hit over the head by reality.
Now you're claiming that this is a cult, and yet we're seeing what's happening in Australia in the past few weeks or even few years. The fires that are happening again and again, and it seems like it's just getting worse. Are you denying the fact that we are on the process of global warming, global change?
Well, there's no doubt the climate does change. I mean, if you go back in time, the ice ages were an example of climate change, but that had nothing to do with anthropogenic carbon dioxide emissions. If you go back even into recorded time, there was the Roman warm period, there was the medieval warm period, there was the mini ice age when the Thames would routinely freeze over in winter. None of these had anything to do with man-made carbon dioxide emissions. So climate certainly does change. The fact that it's changed quite significantly, even in relatively recent times, and very significantly if you look at geological times, without anything to do with mankind's carbon dioxide emissions, makes me think, as a matter of simple logic, that carbon dioxide emissions, particularly human carbon dioxide emissions, are not the only or even necessarily the main factor here. Now, I regard myself as a conservationist. I certainly think that we should do whatever we can to rest lightly on the planet. And all things being equal, of course, we should try to reduce our carbon dioxide emissions. But the last thing we should be doing is driving our industries offshore, putting extra pressure on household budgets, and risking third world style blackouts, all in the name of climate change. I mean, we've got to be sensible and balanced and proportionate about all these things. And I don't believe that all policymakers are right now.
Now, you made some very interesting comments regarding different issues, and I do want to ask you regarding China. Should the world be concerned with China's attempt to meddle in Australian politics, in Australian democracy?
Well, we should always be concerned when any country seeks to interfere in the domestic politics of another. And the interesting thing about China is that China doesn't regard people of Chinese ancestry living overseas as citizens of another country. It regards them very much as overseas Chinese, as people who should still have their first loyalty to China. Now, I'm pleased to say, as an Australian who has lots of friends of Chinese background in Australia, that from where I sit, the overwhelming majority of Australians of Chinese extraction see themselves very much as Australians first, second, third, and right down the line. And rather than seeing Chinese people living in Australia as somehow agents of China in our country, I think that the Chinese people living in Australia could be very good agents, as it were, of Australian values to other people of Chinese ethnicity. Certainly, if you look at countries other than China, if you look at Taiwan, if you look at Singapore, if you look at Hong Kong, and if you look at the Chinese diaspora around the world, I don't see any reason to think that there's no democracy in the Chinese DNA. I think the Chinese people are just as keen on democratic pluralism, democratic liberalism, as anyone else, if they're given a chance. And as countries like Taiwan indicate, they're pretty good at it when they're given a chance.
I want to ask you about immigration, since this has been an issue that has been a lot in the headlines during your term in office as a prime minister.
Yes.
Do you feel that this issue is behind us? Can the West rest assured that it's fixed?
No. Look, I think it's absolutely vital that sovereign nations maintain strict control over their borders. And what we saw in 2015 and 2016 in particular, but even now, in the cases of the countries of Europe, is a total loss of control of their borders. And what was witnessed in 2015 and parts of 2016 in particular amounted to a peaceful invasion of Europe by people claiming to be refugees, but in the vast majority of cases, economic migrants. Now, I can understand absolutely why people living in miserable conditions in the Middle East and Africa might want to go to a country like Germany or Sweden or France or Britain. I can understand that very much. But just because people want to do something doesn't give them the right to do so. And out of respect to their existing citizens, it's vital that countries maintain strict control over their borders. I think it's good that countries have generous refugee and humanitarian immigration programs, and certainly Australia does. But when you lose control of your borders, you not only subject yourself to a form of peaceful invasion, but you erode public support for legitimate immigration. And certainly we've seen in Australia that public support for legal immigration is much stronger in those times when we've got illegal immigration under control. And the Howard government 15 years or so back had a serious problem on our borders and it fixed it. My government had a very serious problem on our borders in late 2013, and I'm pleased and proud to say that we fixed that too.
And you've been seriously criticized on your policies.
There's no nice way to stop people who are determined to come against your will. There's just no nice way of doing it. It has to be done with a degree of forcefulness. If you aren't prepared to be forceful, you aren't prepared to protect your country. It's as simple as that. There are many situations when we're talking about domestic law and order where the police have to be forceful. If the police aren't prepared to be forceful, the mob rules the streets, and that's the last thing that can happen in any country. If your border protection forces, your military, your Coast Guard, etc., aren't prepared to be forceful, you lose control of your borders, and no sovereign country will long remain sovereign if it does not keep control over its borders.
Mr. Prime Minister, thank you very much for this interview. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.